Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, what are voters in the swing state of Florida thinking about the presidential race? And WITF's trusting news as we prepare for Election Day. But up front, Pennsylvania is a diverse state when it comes to race and ethnicity, rural and urban, the types of jobs its residents have, the levels of income, and many other characteristics. The state's 500 public school districts reflect that diversity. Even though the Pennsylvania Constitution says the General Assembly shall provide for the maintenance and support of a thorough and efficient system of public education, it's recognized that there are inequities in funding and resources. The Pennsylvania Department of Education has created a toolkit for schools, teachers, and families to make the educational system fairer and more impartial for all students. It's called the Equitable Practices Hub. Joining us to talk about this new project is Dr. Nicole Holland-Sims, Special Advisor on Equity to the Pennsylvania Department of Education. Dr. Holland-Sims, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Dana Milakovic, Office of Safe Schools with the Department of Ed. Ms. Milakovic, glad to have you on today's program.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Steve Gerhardt, he is the superintendent of the Governor Mifflin's School District in Berks County. Dr. Gerhardt, look forward to hearing what you have to say today. Thank you for being with us.
Invitation.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Dr. Nicole Holland-Sims, let me start with you. Most often when we talk about inequity in Pennsylvania schools, it has to do with funding. That's part of it. But this is a much broader conversation. What inequities does this project, am I right in calling it a project, but what does this project address?
Great question, and you're absolutely right. It's a project, but it's also something that we want to see as long-standing to support our educators and families across the Commonwealth. But one of the things you highlighted is that the inequities that we see in education are vast. So they speak to things such as societal inequities, familial inequities, linguistic inequities. So our students come to us with all different things that they present with, whether it is a different language or a different background. And this toolkit or hub is a one-stop shop so that folks can find as much information and resources as they need to support all students and communities from those various backgrounds.
Okay.
To ensure that they get the best education possible.
When you call it a toolkit, what does that mean, and how does that translate into action?
Absolutely. So we have two things that we have available through the department. One is the Equity and Inclusion Toolkit, which focuses on, let's say, responding to an incident like a student sit-in or a bias incident. In collaboration with that toolkit is the Equitable Practices Hub. And the hub, as I mentioned, is a one-stop shop for resources from across the nation that speak directly to certain pillars that the department has identified to support equity, such as family and community engagement, disciplinary equity, academic equity, and self-awareness, which is a major component of understanding biases, powers, and privileges.
You know, what you've just described is not something that is unique to schools. I mean, it is a societal thing, and you said yourself that many of these things, probably most of them, are inequities in our society. So, let me ask the question this way. Are schools trying to take on this huge project of trying to eliminate inequities in society, or just what you can do in schools?
Great question. So the goal would be that it's what is within our locus of control as educators. And while we know that the societal inequities are a large and looming a hovering thing over us. We only can control what's within our walls, whether that's a virtual space or a brick and mortar space, because our purpose is to create well-rounded citizens that then go out into society. And so that is where I think we have the power to take these big looming things and put them into school systems to support students to become those citizens that we want to see in the world.
The timing kind of strikes me here. This started, the hub became available publicly in September last month. Is it related to the nation's focus on inequality and inequity?
You know, it's funny. I've had many questions like that. This hub was actually in the process of development for 2 years now. And the toolkit that I mentioned earlier, the one around bias incidents, was actually created post the 2016 presidential election, when there were many incidents across the Commonwealth related to the outcome of the election and students on both sides really not knowing how to process that and having reaction to it. The hub then was created as a complement to that, to support educators to know, how can I create more positive climates in classrooms and schools to support students? And so for 2 years, myself, along with folks like Dana, who's on the line, and also our intermediate unit partners, had this idea of creating a space where educators could access effective practices. And so it's perfect timing, but it was something that has been in the process for a while.
Dana Milakovic, you are with the Office of Safe Schools with the Department of Ed. You deal with a lot of different issues, but a lot of them have to do with something that Dr. Holland Sims just described, and that is, the mental illness, or maybe even drugs and alcohol, safety in schools. How does that relate, or how does that fit into this hub?
That's a great question, and I think when we look at being a safe school, it really starts with having a positive, safe environment so that everyone who comes into a building or into a school community feels safe and supported. And that really involves looking at all aspects of safety, not just physical safety, but your behavioral safety and, as you stated, mental wellness, which relates to emotional safety. And so when we look at the hub, as Nicole said, it is a pillar, or it addresses the pillars in different spheres to be a one-stop shop. So what has been done is that everything is interconnected. So when you go to the hub, you're able to find information on mental wellness. You're able to find information on educational practices. You're able to find information on trauma-informed, so that you don't have to go different places to find the information. You really can go into one space. And that helps, because when you're an educator, you just know that you're having an issue and you need help dealing with it. You don't want to have to figure out, did something in my classroom happen because of the child having an alcohol and drug problem, or because they were having a mental health concern. We want to be able to say, a bias incident happened, or I need help making my classroom more trauma-informed through an equity lens, and this is where I can go, and it will lead me to all of those different aspects rather than having to search for that information.
Dr. Steve Gerhardt, as superintendent of the Governor Mifflin School District, your district has been utilizing the hub. As I said, it became public in September. Tell us a little bit about how Governor Mifflin has utilized it.
Well, the most important work that we're doing right now is really working off of the audit tool that came to us really from a recommendation and getting started. And what the audit tool has allowed our team to do is really help drive a reflection on our current context. We've been in this work for a number of years, and I think really over the last 6 to 9 months, our team has taken a next step, and that's because of this audit tool. And we were encouraged 2 years ago when we started more intentionally in this work to start with the data and use the data to drive your reflection, drive your conversations. And so the audit tool is one of many resources that are on the hub, but is one that I can point to right now that is the more powerful one for us, because the insights derived from the audit tool then point us to the tools that are in the hub to help us then navigate how do we remedy the issues or the needs that have come out of the audit tool results.
Dr. Gerhardt, I'm going to come back to you in just a moment about what you did find. But Dr. Holland-Sims, something that Dr. Gerhardt just mentioned is one of the most important aspects of this. No, he called it the audit tool, and I'm sure that's how it's referred to in the hub. But what you're asking school districts to do is to provide a self-analysis, analyze themselves first, and provide the tools to do that, correct?
Correct, correct. And that, I'm so glad that Steve brought that up, because that, if you go to the hub, the very first page, it says, before you begin, and before you delve into the hub, it takes you directly to the Mid-Atlantic Equity Consortium's audit tool. And that audit tool is exactly what Steve said. It takes you through a process of evaluating policy, your climate, your staff, et cetera. And then based on those things, you can figure out your needs and your strengths, and then know which pillar then is the best place to go in the hub to get more and additional support.
Dr. Gerhardt, before you even did this audit, were there areas in your district where you felt, or maybe others on your school board or in your administration, your teachers, felt that there were inequities and that this was something that had to be addressed? And then the second part of that question is, did you find some that maybe surprised you or you weren't aware of?
So the idea of sort of what drove us to dive in deeper on this. This is I'm in my sixth year as superintendent, and the common theme that I would hear across not only our staff but also our community, and I'm a resident in this community, is the theme of a changing demographic. And that was a common refrain, if you will, about, you know, we have a changing demographic, you know, our families, our students, our, you know, various representations, and are we providing, you know, the best educational program for our students? And, you know, just to give you I know we're not alone when you look across the state of Pennsylvania. But in 2010, 82% of our students were white, Caucasian. Currently in 2020, that number is 60%. So just within 10 years, we're seeing a significant change in race and ethnicity in our district. And then to go another step further, when you look at from a socioeconomic standpoint, in 2010, 19% of our students were eligible for free and reduced lunch. Currently in the 2020 year, that number is 45%. So again, when you look at, you know, from a socioeconomic standpoint, we have more under-resourced families and students today than we had 10 years ago. And so those are just two of many other data points that we're driving, recognizing that our students and their families need more than what we were doing 10 years ago. And so we're not getting more resources, you know, we're not, so we're, you know, we have limited resources, so how do we have to look at our practices to better align our various practices, as Dr. Holland-Sims mentioned, you know, our policies, our professional development, our instructional practices, you name it, to be able to meet the needs that look much different today than they did just 10 years ago.
So how do you address them? I mean, changing demographics, as you said, not only your district, but this is something that is happening across the state, different areas of the state. So how do you address those changing demographics?
We're doing more than just 7:30 to 3 o'clock. Let's start there. We make sure that our families are connected to as many services as they need to be able to support their students, both in the educational process, but just even just, you know, meeting their basic needs of food. And you can see that across the state, even with the most recent situation with COVID, you can see how schools continue to be that provider of nutrition for students. And that was such a critical service. So we not only kept instructing students, albeit virtually, but we had to quickly mobilize to make sure that our families, our students, were continuing to be fed breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so that's an example right there of how we've had to, continue to carry on and remobilize, if you will, to provide nutrition. We also have to, really look at our curriculum and our instructional practices and help our staff become more developed and just how to be more responsive to the various cultures that are represented by our students in our buildings. And so that does take, some significant professional learning and professional development. I know that one of the highest priorities that we came out of the audit tool with was just that, around the learning that's needed, and not just among our staff. We need to start inviting our community in, because this is not just a community or a school issue. It's a community one. So we are looking to embark in the coming year how can we engage our entire community around a learning series about how to recognize the various groups, if you will, that are represented in our schools every day.
Dana Milakovic, something that Dr. Gerhardt just mentioned, and that is that every school year, there's a new set of students coming into the district, whether it's in high school, elementary school, and that right off the bat, there are going to be changes. There may be more students who don't speak English as their primary language. You may have more students or fewer students who have special needs. There are a lot of things. How do you keep up with this? I mean, if a school district embraces the hub for 1 year, what happens the next year? Do we start all over again?
Well, I think one of the things to really think about is that when we're implementing change in a school, it really needs to be based on implementation science, and evaluating where you're at is step one. So doing an audit is really important so that you can see what's in place. We want to continue to build on what's in place and what's going well. And you have to readjust your practices, but you don't want to start all over, because any initiative you put forth is going to take 3 to 7 years, and so starting all over will just continue to sabotage the process, as well as making your staff feel that, like, I've done this before, why bother? And as was mentioned, there's a lot of professional development that goes into it. So if you really think about developing that core climate for your building so that you're doing the professional development and you're making it a safe space for your staff and your students, then you're better able to adjust to those changes and provide more support where it's needed, but not constantly try to catch up with what's happening, because you do have an environment that feels safe and you have procedures and policies in place that allow students to feel like they do have someone to go to, and that relationship at its core is really present.
I want to follow up on that a little bit, in that one of the things in the audit, I understand, is an assessment of school climate. Tell me a little bit about that, Dana.
So when there's a formal definition for school climate, but I think to make it really user-friendly, it's really that feeling you come into when you come into a building. So it's making the entire building safe and supportive for all students, regardless of their background, their language needs, their race, their socioeconomic status. equity is so important in thinking about how you develop your climate, because you really want it to be safe for everyone, your students, your families, and your staff. So it's looking at your policies. What practices do you have in place? What rules are there regarding discipline, and is that fair and equitable for everyone? And when you really look at that and you evaluate your school climate, you're evaluating it from an administrative point of view, but you're also looking at how do the students feel and how do the families feel school climate is and how it affects them. Because then you can take a well-rounded look at, okay, we think that we're doing fine as a school, but our families feel that we're struggling. So maybe we need to make sure that we are doing more family engagement so that we're getting their voice into our policies and our procedures, and we're hearing what's being said by our community.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Gerhardt, I would think that when you are doing this self-analysis or audit, that you would have to be honest with yourselves. I mean, is that difficult? Is it a challenge to say, well, we think we do a pretty good job on this, even though the data, or we've heard anecdotal stories that, there's some inequities here. Is it difficult to be honest with yourself and take an inward look?
Sure. But I think it's, I kind of always have driven myself to have what I call a healthy level of dissatisfaction, because, I think you should never be satisfied with where you are. And the nice thing is that, I had a team of people here that were completing this. So it's not just about any one person's voice, but it's looking at the pattern of the feedback. And so I think that's the power, is looking at the collective response from people on the team and what similarities we had. Now, that was naturally doing this audit team is with a team of people that were already focused on this work and sort of came to this work with that interest of looking at our practices. And so I think what is difficult then is pushing that out to people who may not be as open to that reflection, which is why when I mentioned earlier about one of our highest priorities is starting that learning series, we're really just going to start it with people that are volunteering to come to the table as the start. As Dana said, this is a multi-year process, and so we have to start with, what you call the army of the willing, so to speak, and work to spread from there.
Dr. Holland-Sims, I started the conversation by saying that when most people think of inequity in Pennsylvania, well, I shouldn't say most people, put it this way, many of the decision makers often talk about money and funding being inequitable to Pennsylvania school districts. How much of a factor is funding going toward inequity, and I'm not just talking about funding inequities themselves, but going toward these other things? Are there resources for schools to provide or to improve equity in their districts?
Yes, and so Dana can probably speak to some of those in addition to what I provide, but there are many opportunities through a lot of our organizations, such as the Pennsylvania Crime and want to mess up this terminology, PCCD. Dana can jump in if she'd like to correct that.
It's the Pennsylvania Commission on Crime and Delinquency.
There you
Thank
go.
Thank you so much. So PCCD offers grants around supporting those supportive environments that Dana mentioned earlier. And so when we consider equity, I think that's the important knowledge, is that equity as itself should not just be a standalone. So there are plenty of opportunities for resources, not only through things like PCCD, but also other organizations. I know our patent system is offering school-based behavioral health grants to schools. And when we consider behavioral health, that's a component of equity. So there are resources that are available to support schools around their equitable practices journey. And I liked how Dana and both Steve have indicated that this work can't be done in 1 year. And in the equity world, what we say is that this work is a journey and not a destination. And that constantly has to be reminded to our schools because they want to do something right now, and rightfully so. But with doing it well, you have to do it right. And in doing it right, you may need to take your time and pace.
Dr. Holland Sims, we heard from Steve Gerhardt about Governor Mifflin. But if there was one inequity, or maybe a couple, that stood out to you across the state, what would it be?
I would say the one that stands out to me the most is a disproportionality in discipline in our Commonwealth. That is something that nationally we have been paying attention to, but in Pennsylvania, it's something that is really at the forefront. And when we think about those safe and responsive environments, that's an inequity that is letting us know that we're not being as responsive as we could be. When we think about the school or even preschool to prison pipeline for students of color, in particular Black boys, that is an area that really needs a laser focus to change the trajectory. And so that would be the inequity that I think is most paramount at this point.
What you're referring to is the data showing that black boy students, especially black male students in particular, are disciplined more often and disciplined more harsh than counterparts, even African-American girls. Even though we just did a program a couple weeks ago where we're finding that that's something that is not discussed as much as what it should be.
Right.
But Dana Milakovic, let's talk about that a little bit. How does this hub address that inequity?
I think that it addresses the inequity, first off, by going back to what Dr. Gerhardt said about looking inside yourself and this being a journey where you need to be self-reflective and take the willing. It is baby steps to be able to say, because the first step is saying we have a problem and we are doing it. As Nicole said, the data is out there. And so not all schools want to look at that data, even when the data is coming from their county and they can see it, or their students are engaged in youth surveys such as the Pennsylvania Youth Survey through PCCD and PDE. You still see it from a youth perspective, and districts don't always want to address that it's there. So awareness is step one, and then being able to say, okay, I know that it's there. Now, what do I do about it? Because knowing that it's a problem is step one, but you still have to know where to go. And the one thing that is so important about the hub is that all the resources in it have been vetted and were specifically picked so that there's not an overwhelming amount of resources, but there are resources targeted for your needs. So if you look at the disciplinary equity piece, there is information there about how do I look at my policies and my practices? How do I make sure that we're not engaging in practices that are unfair and specifically targeting our most vulnerable populations, and, you know, specifically our Black boys and, as you said, our girls, our Black girls who are not getting as many news articles, but it is a significant problem, and the data is showing that the numbers are rising.
It's called the Equitable Practices Hub from the Pennsylvania Department of Education. I'd like to thank our guest, Dr. Nicole Holland Sims. She's Special Advisor on Equity. Dana Milakovic, Office of State Schools, both with the Pennsylvania Department of Education. And Dr. Steve Gerhardt, Superintendent of the Governor Mifflin School District. Thank all of you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Over the next few days, Smart Talk will feature conversations about the presidential election with journalists from swing states. Today, we start with the state of Florida. Florida has 29 electoral votes and is considered a must-win for President Trump to be reelected. In fact, only once since 1964 has Florida not backed the national winner. We're joined today by Mary Ellen Clash. She's the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Ms. Clash, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Scott. Thank you.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So Mary Ellen Klass, describe what it's like on the ground politically in Florida a week before Election Day.
It's an interesting time. There, you know, there's just a lot of energy. We are watching as the early vote. We've had early voting, in-person early voting, happening now for over a week. These early voting sites. They're not in every precinct, obviously. They're like other states. They're in select places in each county, and they're getting a steady stream of voters. We now have, I think about 60% of everybody in Florida, if the numbers match where they were 4 years ago, 60% of the electorate has already voted. There are 6.4 million votes cast as of this morning, and there's still a week left to vote. Early voting ends on Sunday, and then we have in-person voting on Election Day.
So
there's a lot of energy.
So voters are engaged, obviously, but what about the campaigning? I mean, the two of us have talked before comparing Pennsylvania and Florida. Just yesterday here in Pennsylvania, President Trump had three rallies. What's it like in Florida?
I think it's a lot like it is in Pennsylvania, and that we are getting a stream of candidates here and their surrogates. Joe Biden announced he was going to be in Florida again in Broward, Fort Lauderdale, and Tampa on Thursday. So immediately, within hours, Donald Trump announced that he's coming back to Florida on Wednesday. We will have Barack Obama here this week. We'll have other surrogates coming for the candidates. And I expect we'll probably see the vice presidential candidates back this week as well. It is because the vote is so close, and Florida, as you mentioned, is pivotal. It's crucial for the president to win. The polls show, you know, it's very even right now. It's within the margin of error. Biden has a lead, but, you know, that could change depending on turnout. And there is a lot of attention being played to getting voters who normally stay home to show up. And so that's where the campaigns are focused on. They're focused on getting their base out.
You know, I heard an NPR report this morning talking about undecided voters, that there are very few undecided voters across the country. What about in Florida? Any idea, you know, what percentage of voters are undecided? Is it small like the rest of the country?
Yeah, it's remarkably small. one of the things that every year we have voter registration and the number of no party affiliated voters has been growing in Florida for decades. This year we've seen something different. The number of no party affiliated voters declined and the number of Republicans increased, and both parties raised their totals, but Republicans were able to close the gap. That is, to me, a reflection on the fact that more people are identifying with each party in Florida. And it's also a sign that people are in their corners. And we're watching that in the polls. The number of undecideds are about 3%. One of the things pollsters have told us is if people haven't decided at this point, you know, they're probably just not going to be engaged.
Mm. Is there an issue or issues, Mary Ellen, that appear to be most important to Florida voters?
Yeah, it pretty much depends on which side you're on. So the number one issue for many Democrats is the pandemic and the handling of it by the president. Our governor, Ron DeSantis, is a Republican. He has been in lockstep with the president and how the president has managed this. When the president said, open up in time for Easter, we were opened up. When, you know, the president said, you know, I'll wear a mask when I want to, the governor has been saying the same thing. So we've had this this attitude. So Democrats are very unhappy with it. Florida's cases are not rising as quickly as other parts of the country, but they're also not they're not declining. We are seeing, 1% rise in cases every day. And the issue for Republicans is the economy, and in some ways the managing of the coronavirus in that regard, where they want to see more businesses opened up. They want people to return back to normal. They believe that this idea that you should just contain the vulnerable and isolate them, but everybody else should be able to operate freely. And the Florida's economy, is so dependent on the tourist industry. And until we get an open flow on the airlines and the theme parks, Florida's economy just will not recover. And at this point, it's stumbling badly.
Hmm. Mary Ellen, is there a voting block or a demographic that could determine who wins in Florida?
That's a good question, Scott. I think there are many voting blocks that could make a difference. We've been looking really closely at the senior vote because Donald Trump won the senior vote in Florida, people over the age of 65, by 17 percentage points. He basically had a margin of like 300,000 votes within that group. This year, that margin has all but disappeared. He still has an advantage, but many, many seniors, primarily those who are concerned about the pandemic, have shown that they're supportive of Biden. So that's an interesting group to watch. Another interesting component is, of course, the Latino vote. With the president's message on immigration, you would think that would be people would be very opposed to his positions, but that has not been the case. It's divided in many ways by women and men. The Latino vote in Florida tends to be supportive of Trump, and those are mostly men. And women tend to be supportive of Biden. There's also a pretty heavy, one of the largest and most reliable voting blocks within the Latino population in Florida are the Cuban American voters. They traditionally vote Republican, and they are very strongly aligned with Donald Trump. In fact, even some of their younger voters, which is an interesting group to watch, are strongly in support of Trump. So that's another area that we'll see how that plays out.
One final question, Mary Ellen. You mentioned that 60% of voters have already cast a ballot, which really is noteworthy. Unlike Pennsylvania, the legislature did not act, and that at the request of counties, mail-in ballots, in-person ballots cannot be counted until starting at 7 a.m. on Tuesday. That is not the case in Florida. So I guess my question is, will we know Tuesday night who has won Florida?
It's a great question. And it's, Florida has such a black eye from how we handled elections 20 years ago during the recount that it has changed its laws and made them far more progressive. And the result is we allow voting to happen starting 22 days before the election. Counting. To happen. And so supervisors are now able to take all the vote-by-mail ballots, put them into the machine, first validate them, put them in the machine, but they can't release any results until election night. Now, we've got two time zones in Florida. So the Eastern time zone, your polls close at 7. The Central time zone polls close at 7 their time, which is 8 o'clock Eastern time. So starting at 8 o'clock Eastern time, Florida will start releasing all the votes that have been counted by the counties. There are 67 counties. We hope it will go smoothly. You never know. It is Florida. but the Secretary of State has said she's confident we will have a preliminary result by midnight as to where Florida, who Florida has voted for.
And that could tell the rest of the country which way the election is going. Mary Ellen Clash, Tallahassee, the Capitol Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, thanks for being with us today. And a great opportunity for us to talk one-on-one.
That's great. Yeah, and hang in there, Pennsylvania. Florida will be watching you.
All right, thank you, Mary Ellen. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar.
WITF's election coverage is supported by the law firm of Saul Ewing, Arnstein, and Lear.
And by the way, coming up on tomorrow's Smart Talk, we're going to be talking with a journalist from Wisconsin. Later in the week, on Friday, we'll be looking at another swing state, and that is Michigan. With information overwhelming social media users, it is important for media organizations to ensure that their listeners, their viewers, their readers can trust their reporting. And this is becoming a regular Tuesday segment on Smart Talk, Trusting News. WITF is taking part in the Trusting News Project. And joining us is WITF's Multimedia News Director, Tim Lambert. Tim, good to have you back on the program today.
Great to be here, Scott.
Here we are, a week away.
Hard to believe.
It is really hard to believe, but a week away. So it is so important. I think, anyway, and I think most would agree, that it is so important that voters get accurate information over the next week. How can they do that?
Well, I think it starts with us. I think it starts with the journalists who are covering these issues each and every day. And a piece of advice that my colleague Scott Blanchard, who is the State Impact Pennsylvania editor, shared with our journalists yesterday is that they don't know what's going to happen on November 3rd or 4th. We don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to happen. And things are going to happen. There are going to be reports of what voters perceive as malfeasance at the voting, at the polls. There's going to be confusion. We are also prepared for disruptions. But what we need to do as journalists is to stop and think. And not react right away and not tweet out what we think is going on. We need to stop, take a breath, and then decide how to move forward to inform our listeners with that. So I think part of it is just finding sources that you know you can trust. And I'm speaking to a listener right now. Finding sources you can trust and just take a deep breath and stay off social media for the most part, because there will be a lot of misinformation and disinformation all over the place in the next week or so.
You know, what you described, Tim, and I heard Scott Blanchard say this to our staff yesterday, about the taking that moment to stop and think before reacting. That's a bit of a challenge because, let's face it, many media organizations are looking to be first with something. That's on one side of it. The other thing is that there will be a lot of people, news consumers, who will be excited to try to get this information as soon as they can. So there is that temptation on the part of journalists to say, okay, here's something I think's going on here. I'm going to tweet this out, or I'm going to put this on the air. It's a bit of a challenge, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the difference between a journalist and folks who post to social media and partisans on both sides who want to try to take advantage of confusion and take advantage of disinformation. I think it's a journalist's role to sit back and gather as much information as possible. I mean, tone matters. That's what Scott reiterated. Choices matter. Words matter. Tone matters. So it is up to us, as journalists, to just take a step back and figure out, is this a legitimate concern? Are we hearing more about this from different sources? Is this happening in other counties as well? So the big difference is someone who is at a polling place may see something they think is wrong, put a video out of it on Twitter or Facebook and get everybody worked up, and it ends up being something that happens, you know, regularly during elections, and just a common mistake or a common piece of confusion. So I think it's important for everybody just to take a deep breath and let the process play out and just try to rely on that information that you know can be trusted.
Tim, I just spoke with the journalist from Florida, Marianne Klass of the Miami Herald. She mentioned, and you know, this is important, that their votes are already being counted in Florida, their early votes, mail-in and those who have voted in person. And their Secretary of State believes that they will have at least a preliminary result by midnight next Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, if you want to look at it that way. The situation here in Pennsylvania has the potential to be much different, that it could be days before we have any kind of results. And that creates the potential for this misinformation you're talking about, or people not having faith or confidence in the information that they are getting. What can we do about it? Is there anything as journalists that we can do about it? Because that has presented a challenge for us and for the people of Pennsylvania.
Yeah, I think one of the biggest things right now is, again, to remind people that this is the natural way elections go. It takes time to determine a winner, and a winner is not determined until all the ballots are counted. So if there is not a winner on November 3rd, the night of November 3rd, that's a normal thing. We saw that with the pandemic, with the primary. The pandemic was pushed back to June. Some candidates did not find out if they won or lost for a week or two. So this is something, it's going to be a high profile. Obviously, the spotlight's on Pennsylvania because of the presidential race. And this is a state the president needs. I mean, let's not, you know, cut corners here. If he loses Pennsylvania, his path is very narrow to reelection. So this is a state that is going to receive a lot of intense scrutiny. And of course, we still have a challenge from Pennsylvania Republicans to the Supreme Court challenging the extended deadline for mail-in ballots, whether they can be counted after Election Day, even if they're postmarked after Election Day. The Supreme Court upheld the Pennsylvania Supreme Court ruling that allows them to be counted within 3 days if they're postmarked on Election Day. That challenge has now been appealed to the Supreme Court, I should add, has a brand new justice in Amy Coney Barrett. So what was a 4-4 ruling could change with Justice Barrett now taking the bench. So the biggest thing, I think, is just to start election night with the idea that there will not be official results. And I think everyone will be better off at that point. If you want to wish the results that come in on November 3rd, that's going to be the wrong tactic. And you know, that just leads to potential chaos, really.
Tim, an observation on my part, and I don't think I'm unique in this. We have been bombarded by political ads on television, commercial television, especially this year, and on social media. I have to say that what is kind of unique, maybe not unique, but we're seeing many, many more of those commercial ads that are making claims that are just downright inaccurate. And so I guess the question I'm asking is it our responsibility as journalists to fact check those ads? And are there even just too many of them? Where can news consumers find out what's in an ad, is whether it's accurate or not?
Well, I think factcheck.org is a place to go for that. I think you're right. There are too many ads for us at WITF. We have a team of 7 reporters, and that's just going to overwhelm us. That's all we'll do. And we won't be paying attention to what's happening with the actual process of voting, which I think is our key focus heading into the next week or so. A perfect example, though, of a fact check of an ad was something that State Impact Pennsylvania has done recently. President Trump has really started to pound natural gas and fracking as a wedge issue in Pennsylvania, and how he claims that Joe Biden's position on the industry is that he wants to ban fracking. And he's really pushing that at rallies. We heard it in Lititz yesterday and in Allentown, and also in Altoona. But the thing is, State Impact Pennsylvania has done a really nice job. It's on their homepage at stateimpact.npr.org/Pennsylvania. And you can see what the facts are when it comes to each candidate's position on fracking. So that's just one example of what a journalist can do. I mean, we have State Impact Pennsylvania that focuses on energy issues. So this is something that they were able to take the time to do. And it's very important because this has sort of become the president's key push in the Commonwealth over the next week.
And what was said is the president says that Joe Biden supports eliminating fracking, and Biden has said that he didn't say that. His position is that he doesn't want fracking on federal land, new permits on federal land.
And he can't actually ban fracking, at least in Pennsylvania.
Right. Well, next Tuesday, Tim, when we talk, it will be in the midst of Election Day. So I encourage all our listeners, tune into WITF, go to WITF.org for trusted information. Tim, thank you very much for being with us today.
You got it, Scott.
We will be talking about Wisconsin coming up on tomorrow's program, so be sure to tune in.